Are you extraordinary or are you just ordinary? I don't know if you enjoyed the Peanuts comic strip or not, but Charles Schulz had an incredible way of capturing life in a cartoon strip. He was one of the most famous cartoon writers for many, many years. Charlie Brown and his family and friends made a wonderful place for him to capture the struggles we all have in life. One that was written many years ago was a comic strip of Snoopy wandering around the backyard, kind of walking restlessly and talking to himself. He says, I'm getting older and I've never done anything with my life. I've never chased a rabbit. I've never barked at a burglar. I'm scared of cats. I don't like to play fetch. And all I ever do is sleep. The next frame has Snoopy laying down with a bit of a smile on his face, very contented. He says, life is so much easier when you understand your calling. My guess is most of us would like to be extraordinary. But if we're honest, we're just ordinary. D.A. Carson is one of the best-known evangelical scholars of our day. He teaches at Trinity Theological Seminary in Chicago and has published a number of books, has literally traveled worldwide, and is a very in-demand speaker. In one of his books that he wrote a couple years ago, he wrote a book entitled The Memoirs of an Ordinary Pastor. It focuses around the life of a gentleman by the name of Tom Carson, who just happens to be his father. Tom Carson moved up to French-speaking Quebec back many generations ago, back when it was amongst the world's most religious places on earth, and over the four decades of his ministry, converted to being one of the most secular places on earth. He ended up in Canada at a time when the Catholic Church dominated Quebec, and there was real discussion as to whether or not you were even legally allowed to try and plant an evangelical church. He spent his entire life around the communities, just around the area of Montreal, planting several churches, but most of his life hoping to see 20 people on a given Sunday. I want to read for you just the way D.A. Carson ends the book. He ends it with these words. Tom Carson never rose very far in denominational structures, but hundreds of people testify how much he loved them. He never wrote a book, but he loved the book. He was never wealthy or powerful, but he kept going as a Christian's yesterday's grace was never enough. He was not a far-sighted visionary, but he looked forward to eternity. He was not a gifted administrator, but there is no text that says, by this shall all men know that you are my disciples, if you're good administrators. His journals have many, many entries, bathed in tears of contrition. But his children and grandchildren remember his laughter. Only rarely did he break through his pattern of reserve and speak deeply and intimately with his children. But he modeled Christian virtues to them. He much preferred to avoid controversy than to stir things up, but his own commitments to historic confessionalism were unyielding, and in ethics he was a man of principle. His own ecclesiastical circles were rather small and narrow, but his reading was correspondingly large and expansive. He was not very good at putting people down, except on his prayer list. When he died, there were no crowds outside the hospital, no editorial comment in the papers, no announcements on the television, no mention in Parliament, no attention paid by the nation. In his hospital room, there was no one by his bedside. There was only the quiet hiss of oxygen, vainly vetting because he stopped breathing. And would never need it again. But on the other side, all the trumpets sounded. Dad won his entrance into the only throne room that matters. Not because he was a good man or a great man. He was, after all, a most ordinary pastor. But he was a forgiven man. And he heard the voice of him he longed to hear saying, well done, good and faithful servant, enter into the joy of the Lord. My guess is that for most of us who are a few years down life's journey, we can remember the days of youth, of high school, of college, when we were going to take the world by storm. when I was in college, I came across an individual by the name of George Mueller. I don't know if you're familiar with his life or not, but he was an immigrant from Germany to England. And as he went to England back in the 1800s, he began to give his life to Christ. And very early in his ministry, he made the conscious choice that he would never ask anyone other than God for anything. Over the course of his ministry, he began a church that became very successful. He began a school and then a Bible college. He began an orphanage, and at the height of the orphanage, he had nearly 1,000 kids. And he never asked for funds once. In fact, it's estimated that he brought in millions of dollars, many not just staying in England, but going to support missions around the world by simply praying. And I thought, that's what I want to do. I want to go to England and start a great church and a school. I want to be the next George Mueller. But as I enter my sixth decade of life, having finished 50 years, I'm beginning to realize I'm just ordinary. Is that okay? As we've been going through the book of Genesis, we're faced with a number of extraordinary individuals. The last two-thirds of the book really centers around four individuals. It begins with Abraham, and beginning with his genealogy in the last half of chapter 11, all the way through his death in chapter 25, we walk with this man who is the father of the faith, who Paul will hold up as the greatest illustration of what it means to believe God. Abraham is an extraordinary man by any definition. We're going to next week move to Jacob. And Jacob is another extraordinary individual. He's maybe not quite as gifted as Abraham, but God is going to move him from this deceiving, conniving individual to a man whom he will change his name. And to this day, God's people bear his name. God changes his name to Israel. We're going to conclude next year looking at the last 11 chapters at Joseph. And Joseph is an amazing individual. He's one of only two people in the entire annals of Scripture, other than Jesus, who no sin is shared with. I'm not suggesting he was perfect, but he was pretty close. He was his father's favorite, and simply because of his father's favoritism, he ends up being sold as a slave. He ends up in the jail of Pharaoh, not because he's done something wrong, but because Potiphar's wife lies about him. And then he rises all the way to the second most powerful man in the entire world. He's extraordinary. And then Moses decides to share one chapter about an ordinary man. I must admit, the more I learn about Isaac, the more I like him. We really don't know much about his life. Only one chapter is dedicated entirely to him. Sure, he's found in chapter 25. He'll be found in a few chapters to follow. But the emphasis quickly shifts away from Isaac to his son Jacob. But just for the few moments we have this morning, I want to look at what I would entitle the ordinary patriarch. Let me just read chapter 26 to you, if I could, this morning. From Genesis, Moses writes these words. Now there was a famine in the land besides the former famine that was in the days of Abraham. And Isaac went to Gerar to Abimelech, king of the Philistines. And the Lord appeared to him and said, "Do not go to Egypt. Dwell in the land of which I tell you. Sojourn in this land, and I will be with you, and I will bless you. For to you and your offspring I will give all these lands, and I will establish the oath that I swore to Abraham, your father. I will multiply your offspring as the stars of the heaven, and will give to your offspring all these lands. And in your offspring, all the nations of the earth shall be blessed, because Abraham obeyed my voice and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws." So Isaac settled in Gerar. When the men of the place asked him about his wife, he said, "She's my sister," for he feared to say, "my wife," thinking, lest the men of the place should kill me because of Rebekah, because she was attractive in appearance. When he had been there a long time, Abimelech, king of the Philistines, looked out of a window and saw Isaac laughing with Rebekah, his wife. So Abimelech called Isaac and said, "Behold, she is your wife. How then could you say she is my sister?" Isaac said to him, "Because I thought, lest I die because of her." Abimelech said, "What is this that you have done to us? One of the people might easily have lain with your wife, and you would have brought guilt upon us." So Abimelech warned all the people, saying, "Whoever touches this man or his wife shall surely be put to death." Isaac sowed in the land and reaped in the same year 100-fold. The Lord blessed him, and the man became rich and gained more and more until he became very wealthy. He had possessions of flocks and herds and many servants. So the Philistines envied him. Now the Philistines had stopped and filled with earth all the wells of his father's servants had dung in the days of Abraham his father. And Abimelech said to Isaac, "Go away from us, for you are much mightier than we." So Isaac departed from there and encamped in the valley of Gerar and settled there. And Isaac dug again the wells of water that had been dug in the days of Abraham his father, which the Philistines had stopped after the death of Abraham. And he gave them the names that his father had given them. But when Isaac's servants dug the valley and found there a well of spring of water, the herdsmen of Gerar quarreled with Isaac's herdsmen, saying, "The water's ours!" So he called the name of the well Esek, because they contended with him. Then he dug another well, and they quarreled over that also, and he called it Sitnah. And he moved from there and dug another well, and they did not quarrel over it, so he called it Rehoboth, saying, "For now the Lord has made room for us, and we shall be fruitful in the land." From there he went to Beersheba, and the Lord appeared to him that same night and said, "I am the God of Abraham your father. Fear not, for I am with you and will bless you and multiply your offspring for my servant Abraham's sake." So he built an altar there, and he called upon the name of the Lord and pitched his tent there. And there Isaac's servants dug a well. When Abimelech went to him from Gerar with Ahazath, his advisor, and Pichol, the commander of his army, Isaac said to them, "Why have you come to me, seeing that you hate me and have sent me away from you?" And they said, "We see plainly that the Lord has been with you. So we said, let there be a sworn pact between us and between you and us, and let us make a covenant with you that we will do no harm, just as we have not touched you or have not done to you nothing but good and have sent you away in peace. You are now the blessed of the Lord." So he made them a feast, and they ate and they drank, and in the morning they rose early and exchanged oaths, and Isaac sent them on their way, and they departed from him in peace. The same day Isaac's servants came and told him about the well that they had dug, and said to him, "We have found water," and he called it Seba. Therefore the name of the city is Beersheba to this day. When Esau was 40 years old, he took Judith, the daughter of Beeri the Hittite, to be his wife, and Basemath, the daughter of Elon the Hittite. And they made life bitter for Esau, or for Isaac and Rebekah. For the few moments we have this morning, I just want to see that Isaac was a pretty ordinary man. First of all, he had some pretty ordinary trials. It begins with this statement: there was a famine in the land. What land? Wasn't Isaac living in the promised land? Isn't the promised land the place that flows with milk and honey? Isn't it true that if we are always in God's will, I would guess you've heard this statement, I know I have, if you're in God's will, in God's place, you will never lack God's supplies? There can't be a famine. A couple weeks ago, my family watched the Prince of Egypt. It's an animated version of the life of Moses. I don't know if you've seen it or not. It's a good movie. But in the course of the movie, it shares basically the exodus of Israel out of Egypt. And there comes a fairly significant portion of the movie that's dedicated to these plagues. And as you begin to watch these plagues, you begin to see how that Egypt was going through some horrible times. And yet God spared Israel, for the most part, from most of the plagues. My daughter came up to me and asked a question that I must admit I never thought about before. She said, "Dad, when the plague of darkness struck all of Egypt, and yet the place where Israel was had light, if one of the people of Israel had left that place, would they have been encapsulated in light wherever they went so they could see but no one else could?" That's how we think it should be, don't we? We should have this capsule of light that God protects us, and we walk through the famine and we have food coming out of our ears. That's just the way life should be. But it's not. Isaac was right where God wanted him to be. And yet, he struggled. He was in a famine. He had trials. Not too dissimilar to the trials I'll bet you have. Wednesday, I started my men's Bible study, and it's already been advertised twice, but you watch TV, commercials are repeated all the time. I'm going to throw out the commercial. If you're a guy, I'd encourage you to come. I hope it'll be worthwhile. Commercial ended. Back to the message. On Wednesday, I was getting ready for my Bible study with the guys. It was the first night. I had some stuff I wanted to do, and I had a few visits I needed to make. I made the visits with the intention of leaving about 2 hours to make certain I was ready for the Bible study. About 3:30 in the afternoon, my daughter calls up school got out early on Wednesday. They had teacher in service, and so my two oldest went to Iowa City shopping. She calls and says, "Dad, I have a flat tire." I, being the loving, kind father that I am, said, "We'll change it." And she says, "I don't know how." And I said, "Now's a good time to learn." I don't have time to go to Iowa City. I have a Bible study. I'm in charge of it. I can't be late. I can't go to Iowa City. So I call Renee. "You go to Iowa City." She says, "I can't. I've got to wanna." And so, rather frustrated, I jump in the car and I drive to Iowa City. I find my girls. I find the car. Thankfully, there's a Discount Tire across the street. No, that's not a commercial. There's a Discount Tire across the street, and drive in, and $153 later, I pull out of there. And I make it back just in time to eat a piece of pizza and head into my office about the same time the Bible study is scheduled to begin. God, you don't understand. This isn't convenient. It's not the way things work. I had my week planned pretty carefully. I knew I had time. But the reality is, even though in the grander scope of things, that's a pretty small trial, you had them last week. You will have them next week. You'll have them the week later. And sometimes they're more than just little trials. I don't think any of us have really faced a famine. Have you ever been in the place where you didn't have the resources to feed your family? A famine means you starved to death. That's a famine. Isaac's facing an ordinary trial, and what does he do? Well, he does the same thing that I do, and I suspect you might do. He gets afraid. How in the world am I going to provide for my family? God, I have to have resources. In Palestine, it's an arid place, particularly in the southern half where Isaac is currently dwelling. It's entirely dependent upon the rains coming. And if the rains don't come, the crops don't grow. And if the crops don't grow, you don't eat. And so he does the logical thing. He panics and he moves to Egypt. Egypt isn't so dependent upon rain because the Nile River is this massive river that floods annually, and even if it doesn't flood, they can irrigate from it. And so he does the same thing his father Abraham had done. He heads off and he goes down hoping to feed his family. He goes to the city of Gerar, and then God comes to him and says, "Don't go down to Egypt. Don't do like your father did." But it's not his only fear. He settles there, and what happens? He suddenly becomes afraid for his life. We talked about it. Abraham does it a couple times. And if you were with us back when we were chapter 12, we shared how that in a nomadic area, it was very common for tribes to war against each other. And one of the ways to keep peace was to have marriages between tribes. And then you had peace agreements because of the marriage. And so if you had eligible sisters or daughters, it put you in a very good place. And Abraham perfects the idea that I will tell everybody that Sarah is my daughter. Or my sister, rather. I'm the one who negotiates her marriage, and so I'm just going to set the price too high, but nobody will attack me because they evidently will want my sister as their bride. I don't know how prevalent it was that people died who were married to attractive women. I know it happened, but I don't think it was real common. Maybe I'm the lone case, I don't know, but as I've gotten older in life and have seen people my age and younger get stricken down with diseases and die, and as I begin to hear their stories, I have this terrible thought in my head. I have that pain. I have that same pain. I wonder if that pain is what they had. Does it mean I'm going to die? I know many of you have had cancer. And I know for some of you, the doctor shares that the success rate against this cancer is really high, but my guess is for some of you, all you hear is the word cancer, and you begin to fear for your life. That's what Isaac does. He recognizes that the likelihood is not that he's going to die, but what if he's that 5% that they kill for the beautiful bride he's married to? What if? And he begins to fear. As you drop down to verse number 24, I find it fascinating that we're not even told what the specific fear was. But rest assured, if God shows up at your door and talks to you and says, fear not, the reason he says fear not is because you're afraid. I don't know what Isaac was afraid of down at the end of the chapter, but I think it's very comfortable on my part to say he was afraid. He had fears just like me. And I suspect just like you. And do you know what the fears led to? They led to some pretty ordinary sins. But I came across this book. Yes, I have young kids in my family. Maybe you remember Dr. Seuss. Dr. Seuss wrote a book many years ago entitled, What Was I Scared Of? And in there, there's this comment. The gentleman sees this pair of pants walking without any person in it. And the person says, I am not scared of the pants without legs. I said to myself. I said those words, and I lied them. If you don't have fear, it's probably you're not really being willing to admit it. The better question is, what are you afraid of? Isaac was afraid of many things that led to his sin. And in verse number 6, there's this amazing thing. God comes to him and says, Isaac, don't go down into Egypt. And what does Isaac do? He obeys. He does exactly what God asks him to. He stays right there in Gerar. And then he sins. He lies. He commits a pretty ordinary sin. Now, please don't get me wrong. I'm not in any way suggesting that sin is ever acceptable. God hates sin. God judges sin. I'm not trying to suggest that Isaac's sin was somehow okay because it was an ordinary one. But I must admit there is a bit of me that's encouraged that even people in the Bible blew it. We don't really have time this morning, but I find the sin fascinating and at the same time terrifying, because the sin that Isaac is going to commit is exactly the same sin his father does. If we go back, you can see in Abraham's life that he, on two different occasions, lies about Sarah being his sister, not his wife. What does Isaac do? He lies about Rebekah being his sister, not his wife. You're going to move forward, and as we're going to see in next chapter, Isaac is going to play favorites. What is the sin that categorizes Jacob? Yes, he's a deceiver, but he also shows a tremendous favoritism to Joseph over the rest of his brothers. I know you've heard the expression that sin is visited to the second and third and fourth generation. I don't believe that simply means punishment. It amazes me how often sin seems to be inherited. If you are an NFL fan at all, I'm sure you have heard all of the problems the NFL is having with domestic abuse. The star running back for the Baltimore Ravens was seen on video punching his wife in an elevator. And there's been a great deal of discussion about domestic violence. One of the scariest things of domestic violence is it seems to repeat itself generation after generation after generation. Child abuse was also in the NFL this week. And one of the saddest things about child abuse is those who abuse their children are most likely to abuse their children. And you say, wait a second, if you were abused as a child, you should never want to do that. The reality is that unfortunately, my sins more times than not show up in my kids' sins. One of the scariest things for me as a dad to look at one of my children and say, I know where they learned that. It's terrifying. Abraham was an amazing man, and yet Isaac picks up his failures as well as his successes. But the second thing that really kind of hits me is, on the heels of obedience often stands the potential for failure. He obeys God. He takes a tremendous step. Gerar is not the place when in the middle of a drought you want to be. It's desert. But he says, all right, God, I will trust you. I will stop here. And the very next verse, he lies. That's the way it happens. In fact, as you read through the Bible, it amazes me how often sin follows some of the greatest successes. Moses will go up onto Mount Sinai, and he will have a chance to talk with God himself. He will interact for 40 days and 40 nights, be in the very presence of God. He will watch God carve out two tablets of stone. And then with his own hand, God writes the Ten Commandments, and he hands them to Moses. and Moses comes down out of the mountain. He sees the drunken orgy going, and he smashes in anger the only thing God had touched he'd ever owned. Peter will be taken, as all the disciples will, up to the north in Philippi of Caesarea, and Jesus will be talking to them, and he turns to them and he says, "Who do people say that I am?" And they give several answers, and then he turns to them and asks, "Who do you say that I am?" And in one of the most important confessions, maybe the greatest confession ever uttered by mankind, Peter says, "Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God." And Jesus says, "Peter, that didn't come from you. That can only come from God." And then he makes his first prophecy of dying, and Peter says, "Jesus, stop that! You can't talk about dying." And Jesus looks at Peter and says, "Get behind me, Satan." I'd like to warn us, when successes come, be careful. Sin is right there waiting for you. But very quickly, I just wanted to talk a little bit about it, because in the first reading, it doesn't make a lot of sense. It says, the Philistine looked out the window and saw Isaac laughing. The word laughing is the same root word for Isaac. And that's the reason the ESV translates it laughing. If you have a King James, it translates it sporting. If you have a New American Standard or NIV, they translate it caressing. It is a sexually charged word. In fact, somebody has said he was so good at it, they named it after him. I don't know exactly what he's doing, but it's clearly not the way a brother treats a sister. Isaac is caught as the king sees him interacting with his wife, whom he's lied about, and he's sinned. And as Abraham experienced twice, and maybe you've experienced, he gets rebuked by a pagan, godless king. What kind of follower of God are you that you would lie to us? Caught. He repents. He gets it right, but then suddenly he begins to face hassles. As you come to the New Testament, there's two words that are translated for the whole idea of patience. One of the words talks about the ability to endure during the midst of difficult circumstances, i.e. trials. The second word is the ability to deal with difficult people, if you will, hassles. We don't really have time. We're almost out of time. But as you continue down the rest of the chapter, Isaac leaves and he goes. And what happens? God begins to bless, and the people begin to be envious of his wealth. And so what do? Out of pure spite, they fill up his wells with sand. Modern vernacular, they go to his wells and put concrete in them. Why? Because I just want to be a pain. I feel pretty comfortable saying you either currently have recently have, or will soon have somebody who's in your life, it seems, simply to make your life difficult. We have people who provide hassles in our life. And Isaac is no different. He faces it and then I will move on. So he gets up and he moves on and he goes on to the next place. And as soon as he gets to the next place, down in the Valley of Gerar, what happens? He finally digs a well and he finds water. And they begin to say, no, that's not your water. The clear law of the desert was, because no one really owns land, they're just nomads, if you dig a well and it finds water, it's your water. And they say, no, doesn't apply to you, Isaac. It's our water. Isaac had a legal right to stand and say, no, I'm not moving. But he decides it's better not to fight, and he moves on. He digs another well. What happens? It brings water. And what happens? That's our well. But what I find really fascinating, as he goes through this five times, he eventually ends up in the city of Beersheba. If you can remember back, and I know we're going kind of slow through the book of Genesis, so it takes you clear back to about the month of April. Abraham settles in Beersheba, and it becomes a place where he builds an altar, and it becomes a place of incredible worship. When he leaves Egypt, he comes back, and he settles in Beersheba. It becomes an important place. Where does God use the hassles of Isaac to get him? Back to Beersheba. And when he's in Beersheba, he builds an altar. He begins to worship. And it's fascinating, as we read through the rest of the chapter, you see how that as he was willing to not fight, but worship, Abimelech comes and says, we see that God is clearly in your life. And they want to sign a peace treaty with him. There's much more that we could say. he has an ordinary family. We really don't have time. There's this end of the last two verses in which there's this transition from Isaac back to Esau and Jacob. I find it fascinating that it seems like Moses shares it for a single reason. Isaac didn't have a perfect family. In fact, his kids brought pain and bitterness. And verse 35, I don't think this means it was a day of pain. I think this summarizes a season of their life in which his son Esau chose poorly. It's a society that has arranged marriages. But did you notice it says when Esau was 40 years old, he took Judith? Parents, we have a responsibility to love, care, train, teach our kids. But we can't ultimately control our kids. And the reality is that our kids on occasion bring us pain. We don't want it, but it's true. Isaac was a pretty ordinary guy in almost every area of his life. But you know what? He served an extraordinary God. We don't have time, as we're basically out of time this morning, but Isaac is going to see God use him in amazing ways. He plants his seed and they bring forth a hundredfold. Now, for those of you who live in modern America and you plant seed and you calculate, I did this one time, how many kernels of corn are on a normal corn of plants, I don't remember, but it's more than 100 most of the time. In the desert, in the four millennia ago, that was an unheard of thing to do. Nobody had 100-fold. Isaac did. Isaac becomes this amazingly wealthy man, not because he was this great farmer, this amazing herdsman, this incredibly disciplined and hard worker. No, it was obvious. It wasn't Isaac. It was Isaac's God. In fact, I am convinced the reason Isaac is shared is because Moses wants to remind us that it's not just about the Abrahams and the Jacobs and the Josephs of life. It's about the Isaacs and the Walts. Walt was a gangly 6'4" gentleman who grew up in the 20s and 30s in the inner city of Philadelphia. He was not a wealthy man. Certainly wasn't a smart man. He finished the sixth grade and never went any further. But Walt loved his Savior with all his heart, and he put his energy into his Sunday school class. He attended a small inner city church in the city of Philadelphia. It was incredibly tiny. But he taught the 9, 10, and 11-year-old boys. Certainly a difficult class to teach, but Walt poured his life into it, and he loved the boys. And every Saturday when he was off work, he would go around the streets outside of the church and he would look for young boys. And one particular day, he came across a young boy by the name of Howard. Back in the days before Nintendo, before Xboxes, boys often played marbles. And Howard was the neighborhood champ at marbles, and he was playing marbles. And Walt came up to Howard and said, "Howard, how would you like to come to Sunday school tomorrow morning?" And the moment the word school was associated with anything, Howard had no interest in it. And he said, "No, I go to school 5 days a week. I ain't going 6 days a week." And so Walt said, "Well, Howard, can we play marbles?" Howard was quite confident in his abilities to play marbles, and so he, with an air of confidence, said, "Absolutely." Walt bent down as far as his 6-foot frame would allow him to, and he began to play marbles, and Howard lost every single game. In fact, by the end of their time together, had lost all of his marbles. But he had gained a friend. For the next 3 years, he would go no place where Walt wasn't. Howard had grown up in a broken family. In fact, his parents had split up before he was actually born. He spent most of his childhood with his grandparents, but his father was an alcoholic, and Howard will share that on many occasions he would go bar to bar in the evening looking for his grandfather to bring him home. Walt was the first person that ever truly cared. He loved Howard. He loved all of the young boys that were in his class, 13 in all. 9 of them were from broken homes. Howard was a young boy by the name of Howard Hendricks. I don't know if you're familiar with Howard, but he went on to teach at Dallas Theological Seminary and became one of the most respected biblical theologians on the planet. In fact, from Walt's class, 11 of the 13 went into full-time Christian ministry. Several of them became pastors. Several of them became missionaries. And Walt changed the world with a sixth grade education. I'm never going to be Abraham. I'm never going to be Jacob. I'm not even going to be Howard Hendricks. But I can be Walt. And so can you. In fact, the reason I have grown to love the story of Isaac so much is God isn't so concerned about how capable we are. He's only worried about how willing we are. God does just fine with any willing tool, not just the extraordinary ones. The question to us this morning is, are we willing to be a Walt and an Isaac? Father, we bow in your presence. I thank you that you don't simply only use the Abrahams of the world, the Jacobs, the Josephs. You're willing to use the Isaacs. God, I pray that you would raise up in our midst Isaacs who aren't the most gifted, aren't the smartest, aren't the most talented, but are simply willing to be used, because I know that you can use any of us to accomplish extraordinary things, not because we're extraordinary, but because you are. God, I pray that we would be willing to be used. God, dismiss us now and send us out to a world that desperately needs to hear. And God, I pray that we would be willing to just share with that person you bring to us this week. And then we will praise you and thank you. For it's in your Son's holy and precious name we pray. Amen. Thank you very much for coming this morning.